Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time to reload this week's news, 312-981-7200. Already people coming in saying, you know what, I've already put the number out. They love it. 630 says overreported this week. Anything Jay Cutler.
Just right. I agree.
In studio tonight, I'm very excited to welcome back two veterans of this segment. Cassie Walker-Burke is the assistant managing editor at Crane Chicago Business. Cassie, good to see you.
Nice to see you too, Justin.
And Charlie Meyerson's back in the building. I'm surprised that they let you back in.
You know,
there was
a time when I was paid to talk on WGN. I don't know if you remember that. Years ago.
You are celebrating your 40th anniversary in Chicago media.
I am. Celebrating is really kind of probably stretching it a little bit, but it happened.
He runs Chicago Public Square, yeah. The great email newsletter, which is chicagopublicsquare.com.
Exactly right.
There you go. Check it out. He's got every morning he lets us know what's going on in Chicago, what we should be reading. I read it.
Thank you.
If you can see that with the impression.
I could, but I try not to pry.
Yeah, you put that tracker on my leg.
That's exactly.
I know where I'm at all times.
And who canceled? Why am I here? No, who's not here?
Well, Andrea Darlis, who will be joining us in a couple weeks, was scheduled to be here, and she had some family issues, but she'll be back on the 18th.
So like, I'm your Charles Nelson Reilly.
You are. You're Al Roker.
I'm your go-to Al
yeah.
Roker.
You're
whoever.
Al Roker.
Call Charlie. We got a gap. Okay.
Fine. No, I'm glad to have you here. All right, so let's talk biggest story. You know, we all kind of. I'm going to make an executive decision. We all agree that the stories surrounding the president this week were big stories, and they possibly in any given week could be considered the biggest story of the week. But there's so much, and it happens every week, that let's go ahead and bypass it. Well, those issues and the issues that come out around leaking and other things will come up in this hour and a half, and we'll talk about it.
Donald, who?
Right.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Let's talk about some of the local stories instead that were on the biggest stories. The two stories that both of you have brought up. Cassie, why don't we start with you? What do you have for biggest story of the week?
I think the biggest story of the week is by far SB1, which is the school funding bill.
Yes.
You know, in Illinois, there's very little that we can agree on. And one thing we all agree on is that Illinois has the worst school funding formula in the country, the most inequitable school funding formula in the country. Well, finally, there was a bipartisan commission called together. They came up with recommendations. 90% of those recommendations fueled a bill, SB1. And the Democrats then sat on it. It passed both houses of the General Assembly. The Democrats then sat on it, itself a controversial choice. Governor Rauner pledged to veto it, and he sure did. Well, he vetoed it with an amendatory veto,
right,
which is really a confusing thing.
Yeah.
And so what he said was, okay, this bill contains a bailout for Chicago Public Schools that I don't think that we should fund. But really, if you look at his amendatory veto, there's a whole lot of other stuff in there that he wants.
He line itemed down a lot of different things that at one point or another he had shown interest in supporting. There's a lot that goes into what politics are behind it, but this school funding formula debate is one that probably should have happened 2 months ago. Here we are at the beginning of August because of politics, August 4th, with no school funding formula. Schools essentially start in a week and a half.
Now, forgive me, I'm not up to speed on this, but at one point the governor said, I've posted to the web a list of all the state school districts. You can go on and see how my changes would affect your school district. And then as soon as people looked for it, it was password protected. The governor's staff took it down. They said, we're working on it. Did it ever go live again?
No,
and
but
can anyone
I think
go
the
to
issue,
find out?
I think the issue there was the fact that it didn't necessarily prove the governor's point. I think at a certain point people started looking at it and they said, even downstate districts have come out. And so this is fair all the way across. I mean, what's at stake here is the fact that Chicago has a disproportionate amount of low-income students. And that's what this formula is supposed to fix, the idea that there'd be more money to disproportionate students or low-income students. The issue is that Democrats, at some point or another, also put in pension bailout, and I use the governor's word, but pension reform, help for CPS. And that's where the governor is, and this is a long-standing argument over this, what has either, if you listen to the governor's, through it's 300,000 or 300 million, you listen to the other, 250, but this is the same chunk of money that we've been arguing about for almost a year. I mean, even back to Christmas time, that there was the idea that State President John Cullerton, he was going to get that money if they could get a pension reform bill in, and then they couldn't, so then the governor pulled that back. I mean, this is all over that chunk of money that the CPS needs for pensions.
But is it? I mean, I think that that is presumably what it's about. But when you really look at what happened, it's really more ideology. And I think that when you look at the numbers, CPS has 19% of the students in the state. It gets 16% of the funding. Is that fair? CPS is the only district for which the state is not picking up pension funding. Is that fair? And then when you look at the number of dollars that are sent to different school districts for kids, CPS, $15,000 roughly, you know, per student is what it's spending. There are districts in Illinois that are spending $8,000 per kid. $8,000 per kid. Think about that. There are districts also in Illinois that are spending $32,000 per kid. So when we're talking about inequity, we're not talking about just Chicago. We're talking about districts downstate. We're talking about districts up, you know, further north than here. So I think what we're the whole issue of Chicago becomes this political sort of football, but the issue is really so much bigger.
Do you think it has to do with election 2018 and the way that the Republican field is you know, with the Democrats coming in, that they're going to need turnout outside of Chicago, of course, and the idea of pitting Chicago versus the rest of the state, is that's a good argument for politics?
You know, I'm not going to get into the psychoanalytical aspects of who's doing what, why.
Well, that's the end of the segment. Then.
I know,
Charlie's
we're done.
Out.
You know, I just want to say it's still – I want to bring this back to the most basic inequity in the whole system, which is, look, if you happen to live in a town with a shopping mall, at least one of the shopping malls that's still active, or a big corporate headquarters or whatever, your kids are probably going to get a pretty darn good education and a well-funded education at that. If you live in an impoverished suburb or a downstate community that's lost factories and all the rest of that, your kids aren't going to get the same quality of education, certainly not the same funding for education. And if you're in Chicago, well, it's kind of a mixed bag.
Right. And that's what they're trying to fix.
And it's something that everyone ought to be able to agree on as a priority for fixing, and the fact that it hasn't been done is an outrage.
Cassie, I will say that on the surface, I mean, when you start playing ideology and politics around school funding, that's always been a no-no, in the way that if the schools don't open up, that lands at the doorstep of the leaders of our state, and not in a good way. That will turn out vote, because it affected people and their families. I mean, this is a game of political chicken that is getting closer and closer to the deadline. I mean, like I said, today's August 4th. A lot of schools in Illinois open Monday, August 14th. Now, Mike Fouché comes out and he says most of those can borrow and keep the doors open. But what message does that send that the state legislature and the governor are not able to get a school funding for the first time ever, to not have the money delivered to the state in a timely fashion?
Well, I think it's the same message that they sent after not having a budget for 2 years. I mean, certainly those were lower income people who were hit disproportionately. But look at the school systems. The school districts that are not going to be able to open on time, those aren't your wealthy districts. Mm-hmm. This is not your districts in Kenilworth and Lake Forest. These are going to be your districts downstate and your lower income districts. So, I think it's the same game of political chicken. And I will also say that for decades, politicians in the state have been labeling Chicago schools, anything you do for Chicago schools, a bailout. That is an old political trick. Rauner is not up to anything new here.
I just want to call attention to a study that was released just a few weeks ago, reported public radio in Chicago had it. It's where I saw it anyway, that showed that if you compare students demographically, ethnic group and economic group, Chicago schools are those students are doing better in Chicago.
Yeah, right.
You may have probably talked about this.
It's a great story.
Yeah, than their counterparts in suburbs and downstate. Chicago gets a bad rap, but partly, you know, that rap, if it's a rap at all, is due to the fact that many Chicago students are challenged. And when you compare challenged students to challenged students, the numbers suggest Chicago is doing a pretty darn good job.
It is a story that we continue to obviously have to, as we get closer and closer to the school season opening or starting here in the middle of August. I mean, but it is a strange place to be in Illinois politics. And I guess the question, too, is that now we hear whether or not, you know, the compromise might be vouchers, where we see that charter schools might play in here. It might be more of, let's take the money from public funding and give it somewhere else. I mean, these are issues that weren't on the table that are now on the table at the last minute.
Well, that's why it's so confusing and so frustrating. And I think that's why the Chicago bailout is such a misnomer here, because you have two things that showed up in the mandatory veto that weren't being discussed at all. Number one, $100 million in scholarships that would be siphoned from public schools to private schools for people who wanted to send their kids kids there. And number two, using TIF funding, so that's tax increment financing, which is really supposed to be used for spurring on private development, that would be factored into this grand equation for how much a district gets. That wasn't on the table before.
Right.
So when we talk about bailouts, I think that's just a smokescreen for people.
Let me ask you this, Charlie, and Cassie as well. Does the governor open up himself to the criticism of this when we talk about vouchers and private and public and charter schools and everything in between? That, you know, public funding isn't going to public, or public money is not going to public funding and or public schools. Does he open himself up to an argument that had been kind of lying low? It wasn't that one that we'd been talking about when it comes to school, by doing this mandatory veto and actually adding in things that weren't necessarily at the table when this argument began?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a well-phrased question. I agree with you. No, I mean, he does open himself up to all those things.
And that can be a base. That's a base that gets the vote out, and that a progressive base, especially in Chicago, that is one that has been a little bit sleepy in the last couple
Bruce
months.
Bruce Rauner has, to my bewilderment, to this point, kind of avoided direct comparison with Donald Trump, and he's kept his distance politically from Donald Trump. Well, there, I said Trump. I know we weren't.
I know we got in about 10 minutes.
But you know, the patterns are very much the same. These ideas that come out of nowhere, the staff shakeups recently. There are so many parallels between what's happening in Illinois and what's happening nationally. The big difference being that in Illinois you have a counterbalancing democratically controlled legislature.
Well, let's talk about those Democrats coming up here. The other big story we'll get to right after the break. How much money you're paying for soda? 312-981-7200. Charlie Meyerson and Cassie Walker-Burke in studio. Stay with us. Cassie Walker-Burke, Charlie Meyerson in studio tonight. 312-981-7200. We're reloading this week's news. We kind of have a double, a daily double, if you will, for the biggest stories. Like we said at the beginning, all the Trump stuff aside, we'll get there. They're in winners and losers, all the other categories. But this week was the week that we saw a new soda tax, a sweetened beverage tax in Cook County, one that we thought for a minute wasn't going to happen. There was a court case. There were layoffs. There are now lawsuits. But if you go to the store right now and try to buy anything but LaCroix, you're going to be spending money.
I think the first thing we need to resolve is this. Is it soda? Is it pop?
Oh, yeah, right.
Is it soda pop? Is it soft drink?
I think it's sweetened
beverage.
Sweetened beverage. Hilariously, before we get into the nuts and bolts of this, really great to see the internet go crazy that Walgreens was charging customers the tax for LaCroix, and everyone was mad saying this is an unsweetened beverage, and even the Cook County Board President, Tony Preckwinkle, went to Twitter saying, well, LaCroix is not a part of this. Like, she had to weigh in on this issue of one brand. That's a lot of brand strength.
I'm grateful that development gave me a chance to use my favorite French joke headline of the week.
What is?
LaCroix de cœur.
Come on.
Because, you know, yeah. It's... Cri du cœur is cry of the heart. Yeah. So I got to say, LaCroix
of the heart.
Of the heart. That's so, good.
Well, this is a big issue.
Thank you very much.
I mean, this is not a small tax. And one of the issues.
Huge.
It's a huge tax.
It's a big tax.
You know, usually when we're talking, we have conversations about taxes, we'll go, it's 10 cents here. And whatever. When people are seeing 50, 60, 70 cents on a purchase of a sweetened beverage, that it's almost doubling the price. I mean, this is the kind of thing that people are recognizing. Do you think it's going to have a political impact on the Cook County Board president after all this?
Yeah, I do. I mean, looking at social media, looking at responses, looking at clicks, looking at what people are saying on Facebook and on Twitter, this is something trivial, though some people may see it, that's punctured the public consciousness and that hits you right in the big gulp.
You know, I'm going to disagree here because I'm remembering the 7 cent bag tax, and I'm remembering and feeling sometimes when I'm carrying a million things out of the store with my own hands because I refuse to pay 7 cents on the bag tax, and it makes me so mad. But I remember the furor over that, and it sort of died down. And the thing I will say is that if you look at the Civic Federation, if you look at other groups that have come out in support of Tony Preckwinkle, they've basically said here, and I'm just reporting, and don't shoot the messenger here. I know we're all still mad about our LaCroix and our big gulps and so forth. But they're saying that essentially, look at our broken government from the state all the way down to the city, all the way down to the county. At least someone is saying, we have to make some tough choices. I'm going to make them. I'm going to take the political bullet, and I'm not going to, you know, kick this further down.
Now, here's the issue I will say about it. And I will, don't shoot the messenger on my end either, but I'll play devil's advocate where people will say, especially people who are against this tax, they will say, will we not wake up? You see this on Twitter, where the governments that run our city and state and county, especially here in the state of Illinois, continue to ask for more and more money, and yet don't show evidence of any reform of the government that they provide. Meaning, there's still corruption, there's still a lot of hiring. And maybe that's a myth. Maybe Toni Preckwinkle has done a great job, but she hasn't done a great job explaining that she's done it. And so here we are in Cook County going, you want what, for how now? What?
You know, I want to back up. Your question was, will this have political consequences? Yeah. My answer is I think it will, because people will remember it every time they go to spend money on a sweetened beverage. So I think there will be a political consequence.
Do you buy the claim that this is about health?
To the extent that it gets people to think, well, if I buy the 60-ounce bottle, then I'm going to pay more tax than if I buy the 30-ounce bottle.
It's not about health at all, though. I mean, it's a sin tax, right? So It's about something that people could choose to not have. It's like the bag tax. I could drag my, you know, Aldi bag to Aldi, but I always forget.
I always I always carry a plastic bag with me in my back pocket. It's no
a
big deal.
Bag,
a plastic bag, not
that's,
one of those
that's
big
just
canvas
classic.
Bags.
That's just classic dad move, though.
It is.
You were doing that before the bag tax.
And the big difference between the bag tax and the soft drink tax is the bag tax is easily avoidable, plastic bag, and also flat. It's 7 cents regardless of how much you buy.
Right.
Whereas this soda pop tax grows the more you buy.
I have to be honest. I mean, I went to the Chipotle today for dinner, and, you know, usually I'll get a soft drink, and I had a moment of pause. I still got it, but I had a moment of pause where I'm like, I don't know what's that cost going to be.
And I've been in the bag.
I've been in the habit for years when I go out to restaurants, I just order water. So I'm thinking, well, this doesn't really affect me. And, you know, I don't buy that much pop at home. Soda, your choice.
But
I do think it will have some beneficial health impact.
But I don't think that's what it's about. I mean, I think what it's about is, what is the revenue that we can get by with and not. I mean, and I think that that's where the syntax comes in.
I do agree that the Civic Federation, I agree with their stance that it is good to see that government is being proactive. And you know, we're in a position where there has been mismanagement of pensions and other things. And we've seen and I can't tell, because I'm not that, advanced when it comes to understanding how governments work. But it seems more and more that revenue streams are drying up, or that it costs more to make government work in 2017. So we need to find new ways to find revenue.
And I come back to something I think I've said every time I'm on the show, which is the real solution to government's monetary problems, and I think it's the fairest, is a greater reliance on the income tax. You make more money, you pay more money. You have a bad year, you don't pay a lot of money. And, you know, I guess legally, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe county and local governments have the ability now to impose an income tax.
Yeah.
But that would be a big and much more equitable way to finance government than we have now.
Agreed.
But if you're Toni Preckwinkle, that's not an option for you. And when you look at the county, I think it's something like 80% of the county's costs are personnel. So what are you going to do? You're going to try to find a revenue source, you're going to cut. And she has, you know, she has laid people off.
And she makes the point, and she's made the point, saying that the stress that some of the health issues that come from sugar and other things has on the health system raises the prices at the health system. That's the big part of the Cook County budget. And she's like, so if you can fix that, that comes down. So in a way, she's making an argument to say she is shrinking government by trying to get people off of this soda tax. Now, soda pop, I'm not sure if everybody buys that. And I think even some of the texters that are texting in right now saying, you know, at a certain point, do you see this even as a bailout, in the way that you're like, we're going to bail out by going back to the consumers to pay for things that you know, we should be shrinking? And I guess at the end of the day, and this is where we can have a long philosophical conversation, whether or not it is, I mean, whether or not government's getting bigger, whether or not corruption and clout and fat has been cut out, you know, because I think these are old arguments. They're like, if there's so much corruption in Chicago, I'm not sure if there is. There could be. There I'd be naive to think there isn't. But I do also know that there is, you know, they cut to the bone.
All of this aside, my biggest concern as a consumer or someone who thinks on behalf of consumers is that there's been some back and forth in the courts for a while. The tax was suspended, and this week the county got clearance to go ahead and apply it. But it's still working its way through the appeals process, right? And should the county eventually lose its battle to enact this tax, how are you going to get that money back into the pockets of the people who paid it?
We're all going to get $350, right?
Well, that is the Game of Thrones move here, right? Is that, I mean, that's going back to news.
Wait,
of
you
the
have
week.
To clue me in because I'm not up to speed. Where's the Game of Thrones?
And I have no spoiler alerts, spoiler alerts here. But I mean, one thing that makes this, I think, regardless of how you feel about the pop tax, soda tax, whatever you want to call it, one of the biggest stories of the week is not only did a judge lift the injunction, but now the board president, Tony Preckwinkle, decided that she is going to go after $17 million, right? And in damages. And
that
so she's actually
new.
Throwing it back into the courts.
And she wants and this money from whom? From the lawyers?
From the Illinois Association. Retail Merchants Association.
Okay. She's suing them for suing.
Yeah. Has that been
I think that's unprecedented. I'm sure there are places that has happened. But the idea that you know, because that was delayed a week and they lost money, she wants damages from the delay. That's pretty ballsy, right? I mean, I've never heard that before. That's pretty intense. So we'll see if that plays out.
Well, that's what, to me, makes this story, elevates it to one of the biggest stories of the week. It's just that kind of 1-2 punch.
And the fact that it touches almost everyone, you know, where it hurts in the wallet.
Yeah, Charlie Meyerson, Cassie Walker-Burke in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get a break for Rob's news tonight. We'll come back, winners and losers. Sound good? Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We're getting a lot of great stuff in. Really interesting about the tax. 224 says, next year, will they be taxing breakfast cereal, or how about television? How about Obama Health, which fines you when you don't have a gym membership? I mean, there's a lot of – there. I mean, I get the point that they're making, that you're starting to get this overreach, this government overreach in the tax. I also think this is really interesting. The less people consume sugar – the less people at the hospitals, the higher the prices of medical treatment will toss. It won't go down. Hospital CEOs still need to make their millions. Somebody said so. The idea that's kind of going in the face of what Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle is saying. So great texts and calls. Keep them coming, 312-981-7200. All right, let's talk winners and losers tonight. This is where we will get to a little bit of Donald Trump. Why don't we start with you, Charlie? It's amazing to think that the beginning of this week was the was the end of Anthony Scaramucci. That was this week.
The beginning of the week was the Scaramucci era, right? Sunday?
You have for winners the new chief of staff.
Yeah, John Kelly. Only the second military chief of staff in the White House. And just anecdotally, I mean, he's kept a low profile, which I think is a victory.
That's already
a win in right. in Washington these days. And unless I hear otherwise, I'm going to give him at least the lion's share of the credit for keeping President Trump on what apparently was a pretty short leash this week.
Well, he had I have him in the winner category, Donald Trump. And mostly because, you know, you could say what you will. He had a tough week when it came to the leaks in the White House, which I think backfired a little bit. I think that the leaks of his conversations with the Australian leaders and the Mexican president showed Trump in a moment that is Trump. There was nothing salacious and nothing that I thought was scandalous in it. Essentially, what it showed was how he works and operates, and that's fine. And he should have the authority as a president to have private conversations with other leaders. And I don't know what the purpose of leaking that transcript was, but it seemed to kind of backfire in the sense that this is one of those where you're like, you know what? I've seen worse from Donald Trump.
Although it did yield one of BuzzFeed's better features in recent weeks. BuzzFeed took, I think it was 9 quotes from those transcripts of Donald Trump's phone calls and superimposed them over pictures of Lucille Bluth, the matron from Arrested Development. And coming from her, they fit perfectly.
That's a perfect place for it. The idea that there's anything that nefarious or wrong, or we're going to make political hay out of it. But the late night talk shows and the memes can have it. But I also think that his speech in West Virginia with his in front of his rally, you're seeing a more focus. Now, there's not consistency. There's no consistency there. Tomorrow he can get up on stage or tonight and go off the rails.
He's on vacation.
He's on vacation.
He's
right.
A working vacation.
But the idea of sort of honing in and saying, Russia is just because people are mad that there's the biggest loss in election history. They're trying to. They had a great line. John Williams was talking about this earlier. How great the line was, where he said, "I don't see any Russians here in West Virginia, Wisconsin, Ohio. They didn't win the election. You did." Place goes
the Electoral College did.
But my point being that he's playing this idea that this is a conspiracy theory against him, and he's doing a good job.
It's still, despite what a lot of people want to think, very early in this game, very early in the Trump administration. There's still plenty of time, if the president and his administration choose to turn things around to his advantage. He's clearly, got the hearts and minds of a good chunk of the American people rooting for him to do things differently. A little discipline can go a long way in righting that ship, and that's why
we've seen him play Celebrity Apprentice in the way he's firing people left and right. He still has a couple of undisciplined people. The Sarah Huckabee Sanders press conference, where she lists all the conspiracy theories that the media is not talking about, including not even like going far enough to debunk the Seth Rich stuff, that was early, and then Stephen Miller getting in an argument with Jim Acosta from CNN on the immigration stuff made him look very aggressive and bullyish. So he's got people around him not helping him. Let's put it that way. As they move forward,
You mentioned Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I just want to do a footnote to all of this. I'm really, and I got a lot of social media reaction to this when I posted it on Facebook earlier this week. I'm really tired. I'm a fan of the late night comics, okay? But I'm tired of them putting a distorted picture of Sarah Huckabee Sanders on screen. You know, one of those moments we all have where her face is distorted. They pick that shot. She clearly is, a little heavier than the ideal American weight. And they put it up on screen, say something derogatory about her, and the audience laughs. Mm. And I don't think that kind of criticism of the Trump administration, that kind of comedy works. Yeah. And yet a lot of people say, hey, it's comedy. They ought to be able to do whatever they want.
Well, let's not forget the biggest gift that Trump was probably given this week was the Dow Industrial average, hitting 22,000.
Right.
And, if you look at what economists say, a lot of this was already in the making, that there's a lot of reasons why this was happening, going back to the Obama administration. But that is a huge, huge thing. And, of course, he went to Twitter to
say it was. And I don't know if Wall Street agrees with it. I mean, we had Jonathan Honig was on last night. We were talking about this very thing, that Wall Street doesn't necessarily move when politics move.
Exactly.
But you know what? To be fair, Donald Trump should accept the applause for that, because if the Dow goes down and it tanks, it's on him too. Meaning, it's not fair to say if there's a crash tomorrow that it was because of the president, but everyone will look towards the president.
Well, no one's accused the Republican Party of being unfriendly to business. So it's not, on that fundamental level, it's not surprising that the Dow is doing well. Yeah. Business, many businesses, I think, see a future in which they are less regulated by government, in which they're less constrained in their dealings with consumers. Not surprising, really, that they're in a good mood these days.
Let's go to your story, Cassie, which dovetails right into business. This is really about, you say, the economic development in the state of Illinois. How so?
Yeah, so last week, Illinois was sort of getting slammed for losing, quote unquote, this Foxconn plant that was coming up to that
it's going to Wisconsin, right?
Went to Wisconsin. And so Foxconn is a Taiwanese company that makes iPhone smartphone displays, right? And so this week, all the analysis came out. So what did Wisconsin do to win the deal? Well, suddenly Illinois is looking really good for the first time in a while, actually, because Wisconsin handed this company essentially $3 billion, of incentives. That's $519 for every Wisconsin resident.
It's enough to buy a low-end iPhone for every person in Wisconsin, right?
Exactly. And this company has a terrible history, of promising to do things in other places. Not necessarily, or it hasn't delivered yet. And also it has a record of labor violations overseas.
Now, I know that, and you will hear an argument that says, yeah, all that's true. You have to put money in to create jobs for people who need them. Meaning that, yes, it's bad for taxpayers at the end of the day, but right here in the short term, Wisconsin's hurting. They need jobs. Foxconn delivered them. And that's the argument back on towards that. What I had a problem with, and I thought was really interesting, was how I think it was a Tribune editorial at the end of last week that Illinois, I can't believe how, and this is the problem with Illinois and this all the political chaos and we couldn't get Foxconn. I'm like, I had a head scratching moment where I'm like, I don't know if we ever would have been in the game if we had a budget. If Illinois is not the kind of state that is going to get a favor from Donald Trump.
And beyond that, this plan is going to be very close to the Chicago border.
Yes,
the odds are that a good number of those workers, maybe not all of them, probably not all of them, will be coming from Illinois or will choose to live in Illinois. And where are they going to go for their entertainment, for their nights out, for their excitement? They're going
to
come spend their
Milwaukee.
Money in Illinois.
No, Illinois, right.
Maybe Milwaukee. But I think Chicago's closer.
No, but you're right. That was a nice follow-up, too, saying that this is a good thing for the northern part of the
state.
And
Illinois is not spending a dime.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is closer, Milwaukee or Chicago? Who knows?
And keep in mind that the incentives are not necessarily all tax incentives. Some of those are outright.
It's not a good
handing
deal.
Handing money. It's not.
It's just
good
not
deal.
A good deal. And once again, we find ourselves in this country seeming to let corporations have a run of whatever they need. And this is something that was argued at the election, the 2016 election. You saw that was a big thing with Hillary Clinton wanting more corporate responsibility. But this is, and we kind of saw it with Carrier a little bit in Indiana, where they were given whatever they wanted. We see it from some of the automotive industry getting what they want. But at what cost? And the states have to bend over backwards with money that is taxpayer money. And on top of it, labor violations out the wazoo that you never want those kind of companies to be in your home state. So,
and in the case of Carrier now, you have questions with whether some of those incentives are being spent on automation. And let us not forget that robots are coming. They are here. Jobs are getting replaced and that we've essentially subsidized that.
And then the final part of that, just to wrap it all up, that somewhere along the line, Trump said, and I forgot where he said it, but he said that Foxconn will be investing more in this country, to bringing billions and billions of dollars more, and that could not be verified. When the White House says that, they asked Foxconn, they're like,
President Trump said something that couldn't be verified?
Right, exactly.
Wait, hold on.
And the other winner tonight, as we wrap, because then we'll go to losers and keep it going tonight, Chance the Rapper, right? I will say I'll put him in the winner category. The kid has not even performed yet at Lollapalooza. It's tomorrow night. But the buzz around his set, what's going to happen? The idea of the Chicago kid who gets to be on stage in Grant Park at the biggest music festival.
Couldn't pick up a newspaper this week without seeing his face in it, and big face, and big pictures. And big face,
not
because
a big
it's
face,
a big picture.
Big picture.
One of the things that I love about Chance's story is, he hasn't sold a dime's worth of music. It's all built on the foundation of giving his music away.
Yeah. Well, that changes now with streaming and things. He's making money off of Apple,
Spotify.
Well, but
he's not charging consumers, and that's a model that clearly is, the model of the future.
But he also has become a spokesperson in a way that, even for the black community in Chicago, he has spoken out on school issues, other things, and even this week, a great piece in Ebony about being the Grand Marshal at the Bud Billiken Parade.
Right, so he's going to be the Grand Marshal at the Bud Billiken Parade, which obviously is a huge symbolic, and a huge parade, but a very symbolic thing here. He's up for a VMA award, which Video Music Award for MTV. He's headlining Lollapalooza, and now there's Chance for President. That's the that's the new Twitter handle. And a year ago we might have said, why would you have a celebrity be president? And so I'll leave it at that. But I will say I saw him at Lollapalooza several years ago.
Yeah,
and he was playing on one of the side stages, and there were hedges around the sides of the stage, and at that point there were kids, teenagers rushing the bushes, knocking them down to see him on a side stage that could barely be contained. I cannot imagine how the city is going to go crazy tomorrow night.
I have to say, the idea that he has had this meteoric rise, it has been one that has been, as there's so many things that happen in our world where you're like, I scratch your head. But even from that side stage where he was, putting out acid rap and moving forward through all the records that he's done to where he's at now, there's a logical ascension for him, and to see him be more and more of a voice, it's really heartening for Chicago. So I make him a winner as well. All right, we come back and do the losers. Cassie Walker-Burke, Charlie Meyerson in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. All right. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Charlie Meyerson, ChicagoPublicSquare.com, Cassie Walker-Burke, Assistant Managing Editor at Crane Chicago Business. In studio, we are on the losers. You said losers budget impasse.
Right. So we all were happy we had a budget deal, finally. But then analysis came out this week that, yes, we are 1 month into a deal, but that the budget impasse is actually still really affecting people. And not just people who are owed money. Don't forget the state still owes something like $14 billion or something. But also the cuts to social services have been so deep and the bills are still piling up in all those places that they cannot be restored. And so what does that mean? So there was a great analysis that came out this week, great by a very sad analysis, but definitely very thorough, about how what that means. And so that means 30,000 fewer kids in daycare, affordable daycare programs. That means hundreds and hundreds fewer meals being delivered to seniors every day. It means women not getting screened for cervical cancer and breast cancer. It means homeless shelters, 90% of them have seen cuts that have not been restored. And so I think the losers are us, the people of Illinois. Because those things have very, very long, there's a very long tail on these things.
You know, beyond the personal and emotional toil and toll of this, was this the point all along? Was the point all along to shrink government in the way that what it gives to social services and to under the idea of ideology, but now really what it is we don't have to pay our taxpayers as much for services that may never come back?
Given that we're pretty much where we were before the rollback of the tax increase that took place under Governor Pat Quinn. Yeah. Well, I mean, for all of these cuts, what have we gained? The only thing that we've gained, and I'd put that word in quotes, is the losses that Cassie's just outlined. Otherwise, we're pretty much back where we were, right? Before Rauner took office, before Quinn.
And I'm not sure that any of the things that were being proposed would have changed that outcome. You're talking about workers' compensation reform or collective bargaining changes in the union. Those weren't going to have an effect on social services anyway. So there is this head scratcher of saying, why aren't we finding ourselves back at those levels? Why are the people who need the most with the safety net? Why is that safety net not strung back up and ready to help out the citizens of Illinois?
Well, I think probably everyone has a story, and I've got some personal stories, you know, within my family of people who are close to or work with social service organizations that were serving the needy that have had to make cuts in recent years, layoffs or cuts in services or whatever. And I don't expect that they're going to rebuild those quickly because there's just as much uncertainty looming a year from now, less than a year from now, with the onset of the next budget. So, yeah, I think that, you know, we're down that creek without a paddle at this point.
312-981-7200. My loser, I mean, it's fun because, you know, as you get deeper into this, we've had good conversations. I mean, a lot of the losers. I had Stephen Miller and Jim Acosta, and the argument that played out on CNN watching that wasn't, I mean, just the fact that once again we're in this position where there really is a push by the Trump administration to demonize the media.
Can I tell you a secret? I don't watch those briefings.
I watched it after the fact.
I don't even do that. I read the accounts. It's much faster, and I feel like I haven't lost an hour or 45 minutes of my life.
We haven't talked about it. It's an issue that really didn't show up on our list, but, I mean, this was an argument that Jim Acosta was making about the future of legal immigration in this country. And the Trump administration and the Republican senators putting together a new bill that would cut drastically how many legal immigrants would be let into the country, and then also have, you know, provisions that say that you need to be skilled and speak English. A lot of things that haven't been in there, and there have been a lot of thought pieces this week saying if you applied this to generations before, a lot of Americans would not be here today.
John Williams explored this in great depth this afternoon. Great show. And I understand.
He always does great shows. Yeah, he always does.
Yeah, but on this topic in particular,
he's great.
Look it up online. Listen to it. I recommend that. Much better use of your time than listening to a White House press briefing.
Yeah, but the idea being like, and Stephen Miller was trying to, he was saying, well, if you look at immigration throughout the years, it's ebbed and flowed. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. He did it. But he was, it's this idea of who's the spokesperson for this. This guy's the spokesperson where he's belittling the media, where he's not coming across in any way that he's has the necessary compassion or even sort of thoughtfulness that goes into explaining why this is happening.
I'm sorry, did you say thoughtfulness?
Yeah. So for me, I don't know. I feel like that's just I would put Stephen Miller, who they had done a good job of kind of pushing away. He comes back for this one thing and he's back in the spotlight. I mean, if this really is a game of celebrity political apprentice, I think he's going to be in Trump's office next.
I'm past making predictions. I couldn't begin to tell you.
My last one is, and it's a politically charged one, but I think that the loser is the NFL. And the National Football League last week saw a tremendous study out about brains and CTE and saw young players say, nope, I'm not doing it anymore, hanging it up, talking about what the long-term effect is on their health. And this week the story is that Colin Kaepernick cannot get a job. And Colin Kaepernick was a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. He's able-bodied. He went to the Super Bowl with the Niners. He was once a star for this league. He chose to kneel during the national anthem last year in a protest to the inequality that was happening around the country, racial inequality. His contract was up. Nobody wants him. Now, you can go through sports analysis and sports analysis to say that there are quarterbacks on the rosters of all these NFL teams that are not as good as Colin Kaepernick, but he can't get a job. So there's a question like, what is he asking money-wise? Well, this week it surfaced that the Baltimore Ravens are interested in him being a backup quarterback, the coach and the general manager. But the owner, behind closed doors, no one will make any comment, but the thought is that the owner has said he does not want him on his team.
Because he's politically controversial.
Right, and he believed, and there's a thought that advertisers and fans, and this seems to me to be collusion at the highest level, where the ownership of this club has said, not this guy. He embarrassed us. He used our product as a platform. He's out. And so I feel like that's just the wrong message to send, especially when you have players that are in the news right now for domestic abuse, for other things. And they're like, no, he didn't do it. He needs to get back on the field. And I feel like this is the hypocrisy at the NFL. Once again, at the beginning of a season, we saw it a couple years ago with Ray Rice. And they're going to reinstate him and Roger Goodell and all the he did a bad thing, but I don't know. There's just a certain point where you're like, it makes the game less fun because of the hypocrisy that they do around things like Colin Kaepernick.
Football's going to pay a price, and I can't remember the name of the school now, but maybe one of you will remember. There's a school this week that had to cancel his football program because there weren't enough kids interested in it. You know, because parents are increasingly worried about the physical consequences of having their kids play football.
Play soccer, I will say. That's the best advice I've been given as a parent of young children.
All right, Cassie Walker-Burke, Charlie Meyerson in the studio. We've wrapped up winners and losers, and we come back with you overreported, underreported, and which story took us down the rabbit hole this week. We're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Cassie Walker-Burke, assistant managing editor at Cranes, Charlie Meyerson, Chicago Public Square, celebrating 40 years in the Chicago media business.
Not celebrating. It happened.
Nice piece as well on the Chicago Public Square in Pointer. So that's
Pointer.
Congratulations
wrote about
on that.
What we're up to.
All right. So let's keep going here as we get to overreported and underreported. Cassie, you got one that is near and dear to my heart in Wrigleyville. Save Taco Bell.
Save Taco Bell. That's my pick for overreported this week. I mean, really, who wants to save the Taco Bell? And it's become this sort of gentrification rallying cry. And
Accidentally.
And so basically it's just a real estate deal. Owner of the building got $8.5 million or something like that. Taco Bell's gone. It's going to become some nice restaurant. Let's all move on.
Yeah, what kills me is I'm like, there was a Yum Yum Donuts and a McDonald's, and there were a lot of other things there that had much more historical value to Chicago and Wrigley Field. That Taco Bell is only been there for 15, 20 years, and I don't know. We kind of made the joke earlier in the week that was your emergency bathroom, and that was about it, right?
Footnote or a side note, in Oak Park, where I live, I just got word this afternoon that community activists have prevented a Taco Bell from opening on Madison
Come
Street
on,
there.
Oak Park.
They didn't want a drive-through
Come
restaurant
on,
there. So in Chicago, they're cherishing a Taco Bell in Oak Park and saying, we don't want you here.
I mean, if this was the Metro, if this was the, something that really, there was a seed of culture there, I could get behind it, but
through
I cannot get behind
through my unnamed social media sources, Facebook. I was hip to the, I was brought to my attention that this started as a joke, this Save the Taco Bell. And once the media, as they do so eloquently, missed the point and missed the joke, the person who was behind it kind of got rid of the fact that it was a joke just for the attention. And so they were like, it started as sort of like, this is fun, this is such a joke, funny. And then when there started to be, then it got real. And so I'm not even sure, like no one's pointing that part out. So you're like, no, we're just expending way too much energy talking about Taco Bell.
And now there's a rally.
Another confession that I know will allow you to make more fun of me, but I don't think I've ever eaten a Taco Bell.
Yeah, man, you just become more and more Oak Park as time goes on. Look at you. You're like the mayor of Oak Park over here.
I don't know. I had my own.
See, I knew you were going to go there.
We don't have Taco Bell. We've got vegan tacos.
I open up to you. I reveal my inner self, and what do? You just make merciless fun of me.
My overreported story, one that I wish never happened, was Steve Bartman getting a World Series ring.
Why?
That was this week.
Why do you wish it never happened?
I don't know. I am not a big fan. I'm not a fan of that story. I never have been. I think the documentary that ESPN did about that experience was kind of a really negative stain on Chicago and the way that Cubs fans acted at the time.
Yes.
The idea that we continually pull this storyline out every year around baseball. Last year it was Bartman going to throw out the first pitch. This year the Cubs give him a ring. I'm like, just hopefully it puts it to bed and it's over. But the idea that the media put it on the front page and we had it should be the sixth story in a news in a sports section. It's like, hey, remember that guy? I know, but
disagree.
I just think it's overreported.
The guy conducted himself with more class than most members of any professional baseball team.
And
restraint. Why not?
He caught an uncatchable foul ball.
Yeah.
That's what he did. Now he gets a World Series ring.
I think it was terrible the way he was treated by the fans. I agree with you.
Absolutely
but
dark.
All the more reason, give the guy a ring.
Give him money.
Pocket change to the Ricketts family.
I guess. Was he asking for a ring? Whatever.
I don't think so. I think it was a nice gesture.
And then the other one, it was another sports one, was mentioned at the top, was Jay Cutler. The idea that I actually, and you'll like this, this is not a sports issue, but all right. I know you don't like sports, Charlie.
It's not that I don't like sports.
I just don't
get it.
You'll get this. So for the last 8 to 9 years, Jay Cutler has been the quarterback in Chicago. Jay Cutler was a polarizing figure who fans did not get behind. He had a love-hate relationship with fans. This was the year that the Chicago Bears finally cut Jay Cutler. They let him go. Oh, as a fan, you're like, good, we can move on. No more of this drama every single year. Fox Sports hires Jay Cutler because, hey, Jay Cutler isn't going to be a Fox analyst. He retired from football. And they determined that the first game that Jay Cutler is going to do in his professional career is going to be at Soldier Field, game one against the Atlanta Falcons.
Why wouldn't they do it that way?
Trolls.
Makes sense.
It's a troll move.
Why not?
As a Bears fan, I'm like, you don't like me? I don't like you. I ain't watching this. Like, I don't want to watch a guy, Jay Cutler, who has let me down as a fan, who does not like me and I don't like him, to be the guy who tells me what's wrong with the Bears on a third down and eight.
Will you not be watching?
I made that clear on this show. I'm not watching. Now, the good news is that it looks like he's unretiring and he's going to go play for the Miami Dolphins, so he'll be out, so I'll be able to watch the Bears. But don't think I haven't remembered this, Fox. Like, that's a troll move. That's a Twitter move.
If that's your greatest grievance against Fox, then I'd say you're...
Fox Sports, we're talking about.
It's part of the same empire.
All right, well. All right, let's get to the underreported stuff. There's some really great stuff here. Let's talk with your Cassie. Police reform came up this week and in a way that I thought was very strange. The reappointment of Lori Lightfoot over the police reform board at the city, but with caveats in the strange press conference that the mayor had.
Right, with caveats. And so that's happening at the same time that the Reader actually reported that there are negotiations starting between the union, the police union, and the city. And I think those negotiations can stretch years. Like, that can take a long time. This is not something that's going to be resolved quickly, most likely. But when you talk to people who look closely at police reform, they will tell you that the union contract is really one of the biggest things that determines how a city handles the disciplinary matters against police.
Absolutely.
And so the fact that these two things are happening, yet we're not really seeing a lot of reporting outside of what the Reader did, outside of the story about Lori Lightfoot. We're really not seeing a lot of deep reporting about what's even happening. Where are we with police reform?
And it is interesting because there was an election for the Fraternal Order of Police. Kevin Graham was elected. Dean Angelo was pushed to the side. Graham is much more Trump-like in his support for police. There is a thought that Mayor Emanuel backed off of the consent decree stuff because it was going to be sort of a balanced negotiation with the police union. So we'll see how this is going to play out. I think you're right. The fact that there hasn't been stories is probably a good thing. There's no leaks coming out about the negotiations that are starting on one of the biggest union contracts that the city has.
But you also have this week another shooting from 2014, another kid who reportedly was unarmed in Lawndale. You have that happening at the same time. And so where are we? Where are we?
And a story that accompanied that, which I thought was interesting, that the amount of money that the city of Chicago continues to pay out in civil lawsuits is astonishing.
Absolutely. You said something that I just want to disagree with. You said it's kind of good that there aren't any leaks coming out. I like leaks. I mean, part of the problem,
yeah, maybe you're right,
part
yeah.
of the problem with where we are now in terms of Chicago's relationship with the police and its ability to discipline police is that, to my recollection, previous contracts have been worked out quietly,
behind closed
doors, without a lot of public scrutiny of what the city, what powers the city reserves to discipline cops who are not performing up to standards.
That's a fascinating. So, that's a good point.
I say more leaks,
even to the national conversation we're having about leaks, where the Trump administration has, and Jeff Sessions today even saying there are triple leaks that are coming out, more triple of the cases that we're looking at. They want to put task forces together, lie detector tests. But I think you're right, Charlie. I think and I think there are times when it's too much, and I think it's politically advantageous to do so. But the idea that our bedrock, the foundation of our media and who we are, always comes from somebody saying, I don't think this is right. I'm going to tell somebody.
I'm a big fan of openness and in general think secrecy should be reserved for only the rarest and most severe and critical bits of government activity. Nuclear bombs, for instance. I'm just not a fan of secrecy, and I'd like to see more contracts negotiated openly.
Okay, for you, you had for your underreported story, this was a vandalism story. This is a good one.
And Logan Square, I don't have the quote in front of me, but it was a very literate bit. It was a Wittgenstein quote that was spray painted
in orange
on the monument in Logan Square, and it was the essence of it basically was, if you don't know what you're talking about, you should shut up. I just thought it was a charming. Oh, maybe charming is a little too much, but
yeah.
It's certainly a distinctive bit of vandalism that I think reflects well on the van.
I don't know, man. I had a problem because there's a little honor and decorum when it comes to monuments in Chicago. There's other things. There's garage doors and storefronts and other things and sides of houses that people can tag and put things on. But when you're talking about that monument and that Logan Square circle, come on, man. You can't be take a neon orange to that thing. That's just then where are we at? What's
well,
next?
Again.
Anarchy? Come on, man. Have some respect for the place you live in Chicago.
Again.
If I find out that this guy, they're going to find out he wasn't from here, because I don't think any Chicagoan is going to go to that monument and be like, I know what I'm going to do.
Again,
I'm going to get witty on here. I'm going to
underreported.
Get a Twitter account.
Underreported.
Yeah.
And so, and your outrage,
I think
is deserved.
Jay Cutler and this guy.
I've got the quote. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Whereof one cannot speak, thereof be silent. So as vandalism goes, I think it's good advice.
Yeah. Just go to one of those hipster bars and see who's got orange paint on their fingernails. We're good to go. Yeah. Cassie Walker-Burke, Charlie Meyerson in studio tonight. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to do what story took us down the rabbit hole this week and what story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from tonight, this week. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, Charlie Meyerson, Cassie Walker-Burke in studio tonight as we're reloading this week's news. We've gotten through pretty much all the categories. We're getting to the end here. What story took us down the rabbit hole? Cassie and I have the same story. I mean, I think it's everybody's rabbit hole, which is this gruesome murder and this Northwestern microbiologist professor and an Oxford employee. Like they
bursar.
Like
bursar.
Oh, was it a bursar?
He's a bursar.
And the murder right around the corner from this studio that they still have not been caught, but they are leaving a strange trail of evidence and remorse. And I mean, what a weird story. This is one of these, when you think of murder stories, you don't get this much information from them.
No. And you don't have these sort of characters. The characters themselves are it's hard to look away at these folks. So you have a microbiologist who is speaking at conferences and well-regarded and at this very prestigious university. You have an Oxford employee who suddenly up and leaves his home in Oxford, doesn't tell really anybody but his sister, right, that he's coming traveling, ends mm-hmm. up in Chicago. And then you have this young guy who's kind of in and out of his hair stylist, who's kind of bounced around jobs, but generally people seem to like him, and how all three of them meet and right. end up in a Michigan Avenue condo, and one of them is murdered. I mean, the whole thing is just, it's hard to look away, but it's so gruesome.
And then, as best we know at this point in time, after this crime takes place, the two men drive up to
Lake Geneva,
the public library there, and make a donation in the name of the victim, murdered yeah. man.
Right.
And then today, the police told the media that there was a video sent to families and friends of the professor where the professor was showing remorse for the worst thing that's ever happened to him. Or
Biggest mistake.
And they're still on the lam. I mean, it's a frightening story. It's one that, I mean, the media is starting to dig deep into some of the background of these guys. The guy from Oxford had an interest in some pretty kinky stuff. And you get to a certain point where you're like, this, you know, there's a lot still. I mean, this is unfolding like a bad thriller. And they're still on the lam. And in the strangest way, I mean, the fact that they've already pretty much said that they did it. You know, usually you get on the lam and you don't hear from them. But the fact that they're sending videos, I don't know. It's a very strange story.
It is a rabbit hole.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I mean, I'm up on the front page of the Tribune right now. And sometimes, I mean, it is the story that is going to get bigger before it gets, you know, once these guys get caught or whatever happens. I think that all of Chicago and the country and the world now starting to pay attention to this. What do you got for a rabbit hole, Charlie?
I spent way too much time in this story this week, but when Donald Trump Jr.'s lawyer promised that he would be forthcoming with a fulsome statement on what's been going on at the White House, I spent a lot of time researching, or more time than almost anyone I know spent, looking up fulsome, which surprisingly means not extensive, not elaborate, but offensive to good taste.
What?
Especially as being excessive, overdone, or gross. This is dictionary.com's definition of fulsome. And if you think about it, that kind of applies to so many statements that we've gotten from Team Trump over the months that it's a word I'm going to be looking for new ways to use.
A lot of wordplay this week. I saw that today the social media went a little bit haywire at the strange NRA video. I don't know if you guys saw this, that there's an NRA video that's an ad. That's the, I forgot the woman's name, who's a talk show host. And she says she's mad at the New York Times. So the NRA, it's a piece about, we're coming after you. It ends by, we're coming for you, New York Times. Right? They're mad at the New York Times for their reporting on Trump. And in it somewhere, she uses the word fisk, F-I-S-K. And it sounds like she's saying fist, F-I-S-T. And the way that fist applies to the sentence that she said makes it a little bit humorous and sexual and strange. And it made Twitter go afire. I mean, there's just a million responses to this. And then she responded, the spokesperson, saying, I said fisk, F-I-S-K. And you're like, and then everyone's like, what is fisk? And Charlie, you've got it. Yeah,
to go or look through carefully in order to find something missing or lost. I just learned something here.
There you go. But that's what they say they were using. But then there was this pushback saying, well, why wouldn't you just say that? Like, why would you say in this video the word use a word that nobody knows what it means and if it's even a word, fisk. Anyway.
I salute them for expanding our vocabulary. That's one thing that I think we can all thank the NRA for, and maybe the only thing.
There you go. All right, so as we wrap up tonight, Cassie Walker-Burke is the assistant managing editor at Crane Chicago Business. Charlie Meyerson is the proprietor at Chicago Public Square, chicagopublicsquare.com. Our final category tonight, which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 100, 500 years from this week? What's going to be the story that happened this week that will be remembered? Why don't we start with Cassie?
Oh man, I wish I could go out on something fun, but I'll go serious business here. You know, I will say that this week there were estimates released about how much people who buy insurance on the exchanges. So this is health insurance on the exchanges that were set up through the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And these are people who are small business owners and artists and creatives, people who do not have access to employer-sponsored healthcare. And so how much their rates were going to go up. And the numbers were shocking. So the median increased 43%.
Wow.
Some increases above 100%. And so I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that we might at some point be looking back and say that this was when Obamacare, this was the slow death march started. Because if you can't give, if people cannot buy individual insurance plans, if they're prohibitively expensive, which they're already expensive, but if they're prohibitively expensive,
right,
and the insurers start pulling out of the marketplaces, which we know is happening. It's happening here in Illinois. It's happening in other states. It collapses.
Well, the whole reason for the exchanges and the Affordable Care Act in the first place, when you talk about this set of people, creatives and small business owners, is that they would have to go get insurance through COBRA and other places that were way too expensive for them. There was no affordable health. That's why it's called the Affordable Health Care. So the idea that now the prices are similar to what those prices were, it defeats the whole purpose of having a federalized health care in the first place, a public option. So, I mean, whether you could politically argue whether or not this was gerrymandered in some way by the what happened in Congress and the fact that and the insurance companies pulling out to essentially mess with supply and demand. But at the end of the day, these are too expensive. The premiums for these individual plans are too expensive. They weren't supposed to be this expensive. It's ruining people's lives.
Yeah, I think that when we look back on it, we're going to see this moment. And when you don't have competition on the exchanges, what do we know? Price goes up.
Yeah. All right. Charlie, I'm looking at you, buddy. I know you got something good. I can tell.
No, you know, I don't have anything for you, and I feel like I've let you down as a guest here.
Come on, man.
But I look at this week, and I all of the big stories we've talking about,
you don't think we're
talking
about, last.
None of them have reached their climax yet. I mean, whether it's healthcare, no, whether it's the hunt for the murderers,
we're
whether
not
it's
remember
what happens with Trump. We might, but I don't think more than 5 years. Maybe 10, but certainly not 500. So I'd say I just don't think this was that big a week that we're going to be talking about this week in 5 years, 10 years, 500.
Well,
years.
Mine, which I think is one that is that I always like to do the kernels, like the beginnings. But I think that the Robert Mueller story, the grand jury looking to what I forgot the word that they use. It's such an interesting word to say they something a grand jury, but
impaneled, which I thought was empaneled with an E, but it's I with an
impaneled grand jury. Just means that, you know, for whatever rhetoric gets thrown out by either side, by the president, whatever, you can't take away the fact that a grand jury is being set up to investigate this president. And if we get to a point where that investigation shows fruit or possibly a chain, some sort of, you know, reprimanding and have some course impeachment or what have you, we will look to the fact that the grand jury was the start of this, and that's what it was.
But in 500 years, you're not going to look at this week. You're going to look at what they do at the end of the process.
Yeah, I think not me. When in 500 years, when my ancestors are docents at the digital museum
for the Justin Kaufman Museum.
It all started in August 3rd, 2017.
That's what it's going to be. So. Cassie Walker-Burke, Charlie Meyerson, we reloaded this week's news, you guys. Thanks so much for being here. You guys are great.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.